Hi, he's Tom and I'm Jerry, and this is the Unstable Fluid Podcast.
Okay, I have no idea what I thought you were going to say, but it certainly wasn't that.
It's Tom and Jerry, antagonistic duo.
I get it.
I think it's good.
Yeah, how are you doing, Kat?
I'm doing good. I am back in the world of science communication and also good mental health, apparently.
Yeah, it may be news to people who only listen to the podcast and don't follow us on anything else, but we're not dead.
We are, in fact, very much alive. More so now than we were about a month ago. But yes, we have returned. It's been a mild hiatus. Think of it as a mid-season break, I guess, if the season is four episodes.
I mean, yeah, it's been like 5 or 6 months since we last put out an episode, but yes.
Yep, it is. It has been a while. But there's a very good reason for that.
There is. There are several very good reasons for it. Largely, we are both busy, but you probably more than me, actually. actually, not probably, definitely more than me, but we will get to that.
Yeah, so I guess maybe a good place to start is where we were last episode and how things have changed since then. So for me, I believe we talked about this in the podcast. I was in the US. Mm-hmm. I was getting very confident to write up my thesis over the 2 months that I was there. I am now back from the US, although the return to the UK did not actually align with the end of the thesis writing.
Yeah, I am still in the UK. I've been in the UK the entire time. Well, I say the entire time. I did go on holiday and I wasn't in the UK. And then I also had a conference that wasn't in the UK. So I've not been in the UK the entire time.
You're just lying. You are lying to our fan base. How dare you?
I know, it's despicable. My last, you know, 5-6 months has been a bit more as expected than yours, perhaps. But yeah, here, there and everywhere. Just not transatlantic.
Not transatlantic, but international. So where were you?
So I went to Vienna. I went to Vienna in Austria. Actually, before the last episode came out, but after we recorded it. so that was for an academic conference called Building Galaxies from Scratch, which was all about like simulations of galaxies. Best acronym ever. It's called BUGS, which everyone who does coding is very familiar with.
That's Bath Uni Guides and Scouts.
Sure. Anyway, it was the first conference of my PhD, and it was good fun. I presented a poster because the idea of putting in to do a talk when I was like 4 months in was terrifying. Poster was where it was at.
Okay, I query you not being confident speaking in public, given the amount of science communication that you've done.
It's not the speaking in public that was the problem. It was the confidence in the science that I had done myself.
No, that's fair enough. I mean, even the... Okay, so like going to an international conference in your first year is incredibly intimidating as a thing in general. So the fact that you presented anything is really awesome.
To be fair, I actually probably could have pulled together some sort of talk, but I had to apply to go to said conference in like late November. Bear in mind, I started the PhD in October. So the idea of having a talk ready to go by February was certainly not a given. So yeah, poster was where it was at. So like work in progress figures, work in progress results, sort of, I exist, this is what I'm doing, is kind of the vibe we were going for.
No, that's a really good like introduction to the conference circuit. As a PhD student, I think starting off, especially if you're nervous about those sorts of things, starting off with either just attending or delivering a poster, because typically, I guess perhaps some people might not know how poster sessions work in academic talks, academic mm-hmm. conferences even. So how did that go? What does it mean to give a poster?
So, I mean, it will vary from conference to conference, certainly. This conference didn't have like a dedicated like poster session. It wasn't a huge conference. There was only about 150 people at the conference. So not something huge like 700 or so that show up to like the National Astronomy Meeting or the many more than that that show up to any of the big American Astronomical Society meetings, but not like a 30-person workshop. A decent size, but not tiny, not huge. But basically what they had was on the top floor of the building we were in, they had like a sort of, they called it the Sky Lounge, which sounded wonderfully prosaic, but no, it was where we were having coffee in breaks, and it was where lunch was served and that sort of thing. And along the walls of this room where we were having coffee was where they put up all of the posters. So they gave us each a 90-second flash talk somewhere in the conference program to basically say, hi, I exist and this is what I'm doing. I have a poster. Here's where it is in that room. Come find me. But the poster session was basically informal during coffee.
Very cool. So wait, so you did give a 90-second talk?
I think it was maybe a 60-second talk, and mine ended up being more 30 seconds because I forgot half of what I was going to say.
That's fair. But what was the audience there? Was that all of the conference goers, or was that people in a mini symposium or a small talk?
That was everyone at the conference. It was one room.
That's way more terrifying to me than giving a talk to a small percentage of the room.
But every talk was to everybody. There was a single session the entire week.
That's not too bad then. I did laugh just generally because I was having a conversation with someone the other day about sizes of conferences, and I think people's estimation of what's big versus small varies field to field. Okay. But it's because I met someone again for the first time after meeting them at a 10,000 person conference. Mm. So that was 4,000 people in person and then about 6,000 had online access. But after going to something like that, the relative scale shifts quite heavily. But 150 is a good number. That's my favorite size of conference, I think, as well.
Yeah, I think obviously I do not have that much experience of going to conferences yet. but it did seem a good size. It's the sort of thing that it allowed the conference to cover a really nice broad base of all of the bits of what was Galaxy Simulations. So every aspect of Galaxy Simulations across the whole regime of masses of galaxies, from dwarf galaxies up to massive galaxies and clusters and stuff. But then also a range of methods of doing it, because there's not just there's not one way of doing simulations. So it gave a broad spectrum of this more niche area. Whereas something the National Astronomy Meeting tries to cover all areas of astronomy being studied in the UK.
So, because you keep mentioning the National Astronomy Association of some astronomy.
National
space
Astronomy
people.
Meeting.
Yeah, that thing. NAM.
Yes.
This is the first thing you need to know about conferences, is that they all have their acronyms, and it will start a fight over how you pronounce each one.
This one, everyone agrees it's NAM.
Yeah, so I go to BAMC or BAMC, depending where you're from. Mm. And one of them is right, and it's not BAMC. but there was a thought, and then you mentioned a conference.
Yes, I did.
So you've been to conferences before then?
I've attended a National Astronomy Meeting virtually. It was in a summer. The department paid for me to attend virtually when it was in Warwick.
Ah, funny coinkydinks. Hmm. That will be explained later.
Yes, it will.
But the fact that you got to experience a conference, even virtually, which as a disclaimer, conferences can be done to very high levels virtually. And don't discredit it if you can't afford the travel or if you want to attend something but you can't make the dates, whatever. Virtual attendances of conferences can be done 10 out of 10, so don't discredit them entirely. But the fact that you got to go to a conference as an undergrad is incredibly cool. Is that something that is commonly done in St. Andrews, or was that an academic that sort of was looking after you? Or
That is not overly common. I did get told that it was not a thing that the school typically did, but it was the year I'd finished being school president at St. Andrews in physics, and the head of school was had previously been my summer project supervisor and was going to be my master supervisor. He's like, yeah, sure, we'll pay it. It's £55, who cares?
I love that. I think that is actually a good, if you are still at an institution and you are kind of curious about research in that sort of way, something like that, I think it's more common to go to a conference that's being hosted at your home institution, just because, again, trying to afford the travel or the costs. I know a lot of people that have quote unquote attended conferences by volunteering at them. So being the person that signposts and directs, normally you can sit in the back of some of the talks that you're interested in. So if you are kind of curious about how to sneak in a bit early, and you don't have a mate on the inside to smuggle you, volunteering or asking academics at your home institution if you are still part of them is normally a really fun way to kind of sneak in.
Yeah, it's one of those things that, like, the worst thing they can say is no, so it's worth asking.
Yeah, definitely. And I think a lot of the times, there's obviously a level of what's outside of our control, but generally speaking, academics are going to be more than happy to engage with someone who's also passionate and curious about the topic. You would hope.
Yeah.
We do come in all shape, sizes, and personality types. So, but most people are pretty pro helping the next generation of academics through.
The good ones are, anyway.
So going back to the sort of international aspect, I realize we focused in on conferences a little bit there. How did you find the traveling internationally? Were you part of a group, or was it just you going to this conference?
So there were three of us going from, actually from my research group. My supervisor was going, and so was one of the other PhD students. But we all, because of the wonders of university travel bookings, we were all traveling separately. My supervisor went by train because she has like fellowship money that can pay for expensive transport. I flew from Cardiff.
Wop wop.
It was KLM, so it was at least a nice airline. But yeah, it was flying to Vienna from Cardiff by Amsterdam. And it was fine. It was, I got wonderfully confused by the Schengen area in the EU.
It is different now.
It's not even so much that, it's that I've never had a within Europe, a within the Schengen area flight. Like, any time I'd flown to Europe before, it was from the UK, which is not part of the Schengen area. I never was. The idea behind the Schengen area is that you get, your passport checked when you enter and when you leave the Schengen area, and you can move wherever you want within it without having to go through, passport control every time you cross an international border. I did not realise this. So I flew from Cardiff to Amsterdam, got my passport checked, and got it stamped because we're now outside the EU and we get passport stamps now. I then got a connecting flight from Amsterdam to Vienna. Got off the plane in Vienna, collected my bag, got out of the airport and think, hang on, I've not gone through passport control, and was very confused. Turns out you don't have to, but I got just like, have I missed this somehow?
I honestly can't remember.
No, it was fine. I had to go and ask somebody. I'm like, I feel like they should have gone through this, but what, huh?
I think you might be one of the only people that have asked for extra passport, extra security. You're like, you know what? I enjoyed going through security so much. I want to go again.
I just didn't want deported halfway through the conference.
Nah, they'll just get you on your way out.
Yeah, no, the traveling internationally was actually, it was okay, apart from the minor confusions around things like how passports work within Europe. I got there. I enjoyed Austrian trains because they showed up on time and weren't crap. And then Vienna was a really nice city, actually. It didn't feel as busy as I expect a capital city to feel either. I think probably because it was just full of public transport, which is nice.
Yeah, turns out when everything moves efficiently, you don't get a load of backed up traffic and congestion.
Yeah, to be fair, I also went in February, which I typically would not do, but
yeah, perhaps you missed a lot of the tourists as well.
Probably, yeah. That's kind of been my academic travel beyond a train to Swansea. So I'm not counting that really as proper academic travel. But you've done significantly more international travel than me, at least in terms of flight time.
Yes, and we don't need to fully address my carbon footprint. I have done as much offsetting as I possibly can. And I am now, at the very least, for a little bit longer in the UK. So I spent 2 months out in the US visiting my PhD supervisor, who moved out there in October last year. The compromise of him abandoning me, who didn't abandon me, but the compromise of him being abroad was that he would help fund my last months of PhD.
Mm-hmm.
So I went out there to kind of work with him. It was essentially a research visit, and the wonderful benefit of that was that we managed to put out some really good research. So I was there to write a paper but also write up the PhD. I remember when it was floated to me, so I'm really fortunate that I've done quite a few different international trips during my PhD. I went to a conference in Japan, and I've been to a conference I've been to a workshop in Chile. So I've done like a fair few bits of travel, but that was only for a week at a time. Mm-hmm. Or 2 weeks for Japan, because we snuck a holiday in there as well.
As you do. But you've gone that far. You might as well.
Yeah. It's a long way for that much jet lag to only stay for a week. Yeah. Also, it was Japan and I've always wanted to go. So that was very cool. But the idea of spending 2 months abroad kind of terrified me a little bit. Like, yeah. I'm not a nomadic sort of person. I'm very much I like my comforts. I like my home. I like, you know, being cozy and familiar. So it was one of those things that I'm really glad I did. But leading up to it, the anxiety was like getting higher and higher. And I think this is something that is not uncommon, but it kind of sometimes can be a little bit hard to find. But going and doing research visits while you're doing a PhD. And typically the benefit is that you do get to go visit an entirely new place.
Yeah, it's certainly something I've heard of people doing and I've been told might happen for me at some point, but probably not for like 2 months. Yeah, I was going to say my supervisor has sold collaborators in Germany because where she did her PhD. Mm-hmm. Not PhD, postdoc. And each of the PhD students in our group has like gone and spent like 2-3 weeks out in Munich.
And I highly recommend it if people have the opportunity, because as well, you're away from your regular obligations. Mm-hmm. Typically, it's a very focused amount of time to do research. So they are very intense trips because you essentially remove all of the excess stuff.
Yeah.
Like admin or teaching or social life.
Yeah.
From the situation.
I'm sure they do wonders for everyone's mental health.
Yeah. So I was really worried about this. I'm going to be honest, being completely transparent. It was really scary and something that, you know, even as a kid, we went on holiday to Europe, maybe. And that was sort of the furthest I'd been afar. But I'm really fortunate that my supervisor made a big effort to try and introduce me to a bunch of different people while I was there. And I ended up befriending the most wonderful group of PhD students. That essentially I sent an email to this professor that organized the Women in Maths events. And she, within like 20 minutes of me sending her this email, she knocked on the door to the office I was in, went, come with me, and then dragged me downstairs to the basement where they keep the PhD. I'm not kidding. The basement where they keep the PhD.
Every
students.
Sentence is getting more and more dodgy.
So she's just like, follow me. And I'm like, okay. So we go down these stairs and there's this, they have their like staff room, but like grad lounge, like specifically for the grad students. And I'm going to slip into calling PhD students grad students because that's how they refer to them in America. Mm-hmm. But it's just this lounge with like a load of some tables, chairs, some sofas and like a giant chalkboard. And there's just a bunch of people in there. And this professor goes, right, this is Kat. Kat, these are the grad students. Enjoy. And then she leaves. And it was the best thing to happen to me while I was out there, to be honest, because they were incredibly wonderful. They're all as insane as I am. And they basically took me under their wing and I got to sneak in and pretend to be an American grad student for 2 months.
Despite sounding incredibly not American.
I slowly picked up some accent, but one of them kept trying to get me to go yeehaw and I couldn't. I still can't. That was the most British way of saying it possible. I think I picked up like Saturday as like the most Americanized my accent went.
You used to say like y'all a bit before you went to the States. It did increase.
It is my favorite gender neutral term for a collective group of people because I find it much easier to say y'all than I do folk or folks. Because I want to say the L in folk.
See, that's the thing is I don't say the L, I just say folk.
Yeah, I can't do it. So, but like y'all is really fun. So I now consciously, if I'm not doing it unconsciously, use that. But yeah, so I managed to sort of get adopted by this wonderful group of grad students. And I was having really regular meetings with my supervisor. So we were getting, like I managed to go from having about 80% of the 2D model that I was working on done, so the first big project that I was done, to finishing that and finishing a 3D model. So
doing
PhD work, I think, as you get more and more, as you learn more and more throughout the process, the speed at which your output increases exponentially.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like, I'm finding that already and I'm a year in.
Yeah, so that, like, last 3 months of research where I was like, right, getting ready to go to the US and spending time in the US, I managed to do the thing I set out to do, which was finish all my research and get all of the work that I wanted to do or that I needed to do for my PhD done. I went out there with the idea of finishing writing up.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not do that. Almost like writing down 4 years, 3 years of work takes a little while.
Stuff always takes longer than you think it's going to. Before we sort of dive deeper into that sort of topic, I guess the one thing we haven't really touched on with like traveling as part of a PhD, as part of any sort of academic, is like, where does the money come from?
That is a very good question, because if people are thinking I splurged on 2 months of hotels and staying in the US or any sort of accommodation, that is not the case.
Yeah, because like we're not paid that much as PhD students. Like the PhD stipend in the UK at the minute is like 18,600. It's going up to like 19,200 next year. But
and to be transparent, that is tax-free.
And 19,000 pounds is not that much in the grand scheme of things.
It disappears very quickly, especially the confined of living in university towns. But I'd say we're still doing okay. So it varies heavily, but typically most institutions, if you're on a stipend, if you're doing self-funded PhDs, it tends to be quite different. But if you're on any sort of stipendary PhD position in the UK, I'm going to narrow down just because, again, it works very differently. I learned a lot about the US PhD program. If you're on a stipend in the UK, there is typically some amount of training budget available mm-hmm. for you. So that will vary institution to institution, whether you're part of a CDT. But most places, to kind of make the appeal better, because you're expected to go to these sorts of training events, they'll offer some sort of compensation.
Yeah.
So it's not like a limitless pot.
No.
Most places will either say a fixed amount per year or a fixed lump sum over the 4 years.
Yeah.
And loosely, that's there to kind of cover conference travel, any sort of we always called it a training support fund, so anything that you can justify as training.
Yeah, I think my CDT calls it a research training support grant.
But that's not to say that if you're on a PhD program or if you're looking at applying to PhDs and it doesn't come with that, that you can't do these things or you'll have to front them up front. A lot of conferences, especially the big ones, do tend to have some sort of grant money that you can apply for. And normally those grants are only available in the case of you don't have other money access.
Yeah. So it's normally your later PhD students or your self-funded PhD students that are going to be accessing those funds.
Yeah. And especially when you're writing those sorts of applications, if it's your first conference or you're like a big conference, typically, you know, it's a case-by-case application process. And there are also other companies that will do grants. So I know Santander do a travel grant for PhDs that you can apply to, just because that's one that I remember actually writing an application for a while ago. And there are like other institutions and also normal funding pots that you can go for.
And sometimes supervisors have a bit of extra cash sitting around as well.
Yeah, but it is basically expected that any travel or anything you do as part of your job should basically be covering the pay for. Now, that's not to say that you can then go to like 8 international conferences in a year. I think typically most PhD students will do one big international one. And I say big meaning like on the order of thousands or potentially like transatlantic travel. And then maybe like 1 or 2 UK conferences a year, I think is what I've seen people do. Maybe like a day one, a big one, or like a workshop. But it really varies. I know people that have kind of spent everything in their first few years, and I know people that hold off and then only go in their final year.
Okay, you've managed to restrain yourself for 40 minutes of recording.
I did so good.
Yeah, you've managed to restrain yourself. But I think fine. Okay, right. You can break the news to the podcast.
So can I redo the intro really quickly? Is that
sure.
Okay? You can leave it in. Hi, he's Tom and I'm Dr. Jerry. this is the Unstable Flow podcast because I have a doctorate.
Yeah, well done. Well done.
I got my PhD.
Yeah,
are we swearing in this podcast?
I can bleep it out.
Yeah, so since I saw everyone last saying, oh yes, I'm going to write up my thesis and it's taking longer than I thought, I have managed to not only finish writing my thesis, which felt like that would take an absolute age, I have vivaed. And I have correctioned, which if you don't know the PhD structure or your PhD structure is different to the UK system, those words might mean nothing to you. But for all intents and purposes, unless a board of studies meet and say, actually, no, which they shouldn't, there's no reason for them to. There is nothing stopping me from going and getting a very fancy looking piece of paper that says I'm a doctor in about 5 months.
When you said like board of studies says actually, my brain was just like, it's just envisioned a load of like people in search to be like, actually. but yeah, no, it's that's great. I am very happy for you, Kat. Well done. And that is... You seem a hell of a lot happier than you did a month and a half ago.
It's funny how that works.
Yeah, it's almost like you got out from under the crushing pressure of trying to finish.
So I think I've told this story like multiple times by now, dotted around the internet. But I found when I was like in my undergrad, I think, this form I filled out when I was 11 saying, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I'd put researcher down. Mm-hmm. I'd put like, I want to keep learning. I want to be a researcher. So just to give you some like sense of scale for how long I have wanted this and been working for this, it's been a hot minute. I have only used the phrase doctor's orders like 8 times so far, which I think shows great restraint for me. So sense of scale, brief explanation of how it works in the UK system, because it is different everywhere. And again, I now have a think tank of American grad students to query every time something comes up, which is a lot of fun because I was like, I passed my viva. And they were like, what the f is a viva?
Or do they call it a thesis defense or something?
So they just have a defense and the structure is very different. In the UK, you write your thesis. That's pretty universal. That then gets sent to your doctoral college, your board of studies, whoever, the big admin team. But they send it to 2 people. So there are 2 examiners that affect your research, basically. They're the ones that are actually examining you. You have your internal examiner, who's someone from your institution, from your department, typically, but it doesn't have to be. And then your external examiner. And they are someone who is big in your field or just like very knowledgeable about your specific research topic.
Yeah, they're normally somebody sort of senior lecturer type level or above.
Yeah. So there are restrictions on what you have to have done as an academic before you can be an external examiner. And that's different every institution. But yeah, so it's the board of studies who are the ones that kind of sign off on all of the admin on this stuff. And they're essentially a bunch of senior lecturers from across different departments who are the ones that are like checking, like, is it actually, was it a good enough thesis? Was it this? Was it that? Is the admin done correctly? They are the big mysterious figures behind the curtain that we don't look at.
Yeah, they're the people that happen between you hitting submit and the thing coming up saying this is fine.
Your examiners are chosen by your supervisor and then approved by this board. So we actually chose the examiners, or my supervisor chose the examiners. He did ask for sort of my opinions, but it was very much down to him. To sort of sign off on that, and I'm lucky that I'd met a lot of people through networking, but yeah, anyway. So we actually knew who my examiners were, and he picked examiners for me based on whether or not they would be free during the time that I was planning on vivering. So by the time that I'd made the decision to submit and I had a job lined up that we'll talk about later, I worked backwards from that. So I sort of chose when I knew I wanted my viva to be, which then chose when I wanted to finish by, because I knew I wasn't finishing in March while I was out there. And it also worked out for me that my supervisor was visiting the UK during that time, because they don't have to be present. Your supervisor doesn't have to be at your viva, but it is strongly recommended that they are in the vicinity.
Yeah, not necessarily in the room, but in the department at least.
Actually strongly discouraged that they're in the room, because they tend to get involved and they need to sit down and be quiet.
Yes.
But yeah, because my supervisor was in the US, obviously that added a little extra complication. So we sort of worked out when he would be available, and that worked out for me, and then we went from there. By the time that my thesis was actually handed in, it wasn't that long between then and the viva date, so we did a lot of our admin very run mode once it got down to it. But yeah, so you hand in, you submit online, which is really anticlimactic. I just uploaded the PDF, I sent it to Moodle. I was like, cool. And then normally if it's if there is quite a short turnaround between the submission and the Viva date, you typically send an email to your external and internal examiner just being like, by the way, here you go. But that's not always done. Sometimes you just leave it through the admin process. Yeah,
depends how reliable your admin process is at sending things out in a timely manner.
Yes. So my examiners were only actually like formally appointed 2 weeks before my Viva date, even though they'd known about it for months. So it was a whole thing. But yeah, so then the Viva, right? So this is the thing. This is the, for us, so at some institutions, once you've like written it and submitted it, you kind of know that you've passed. That is like, I would say about 85% of the case in the UK. Like, it is very, very rare that people fail at the Viva.
Yeah, I think I saw a stat once that it's like 2-3% of people fail their PhD at the Viva stage, because most of the people that would not, the vast majority of people that would not pass the Viva have either left before they get to the Viva stage, or the supervisor just doesn't let them do the Viva until they're ready.
Your supervisor should read everything you've written at least once before it goes through. So you're expected, like, I think it's part of their obligation. And again, varies institution to institution. They have to read through at least once in Beth. But they generally, like, it's bad for everyone if you fail, so they don't want you to fail. And there are actually a series of different, it's not just pass or fail at the Viva. So there's actually, I think, 6 different options, or there is in Bath. So there is pass with no corrections. So 100% everything you wrote is perfect, done. That is like gold standard, incredibly rare normally, because the next one down from that is pass with minor corrections. Minor corrections being typos, font setting,
reformatting figures,
change, yeah, figures, like potentially add a little bit more explanation or detail here and there, but no substantial work. Yeah. At that point, you can think of that one as like getting feedback from a book editor, yeah, right? Like, it's just mix and matching some of the aesthetic choices or the technical detail choices, not redoing work.
Yeah.
And that normally you're given, I think, between 1 and 3 months to do.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's 1 month. I'm not sure.
I think it's 3 months.
Yeah. And that can be, you know, 1 month if you have nothing immediately lined up or you know you can get it done quickly. 3 months if you are going straight into a job or you have other commitments, yeah, that you want the extra time to get done. Below that, then, you have pass with major corrections. Mm-hmm. So that is normally there's a bit more work that needs to be done, or there's an error somewhere that, like, you've managed to convince them during the Viva that the overall work is still correct, or the overall point you're getting across is right, but something in there needs to be substantially reworked.
Yeah.
But they're confident that that can be reworked to give you enough content for an actual Viva.
Yeah.
So that then would be up to 6 months, mm-hmm, of corrections. So those are sort of your pass conditions where you leave without having to do any more examination. Any and all three of those is still like, I mean, I would say the first 4 are still reason to celebrate, but those are the pass,
yes,
conditions. And I say pass with quotation marks because they all have different things. The one under that, so most people know about those. Most people think that it's pass with no corrections, pass with corrections, or fail.
Yep.
And that's not the case. So you've got 3 just in the pass condition. The next one down is serious reworking and then Reviva. Mm-hmm. And that is, again, sort of, you know, you've got substantial corrections, but we also want to check that we need to go into it in more detail,
yeah,
or we need to check that the work is yours, or there's not enough substantial work here. Yeah. So it needs to be retested. So that is an option that can happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, again, it's not the most common. I think most people fall into the pass with corrections,
yeah,
category, and then major, minor. Again, it varies personal circumstance. Most people are going to be there. But you can Reviva. You can not Reviva or choose not to Reviva and instead go for, and again, this is going to vary institution to institution, but Bath at the very least had a MPhil option.
Cardiff has
so
the same.
It's not a fail out. So you're not failing out, but instead of going for the full PhD, you accept a Master of Philosophy degree.
Rather than Doctor of Philosophy.
The idea that people get to the end and then don't leave with a PhD can be really intimidating, but for a lot of people, it's like, I want proof that I've done this work. And a lot of the times the skills that you pick up along the aspect of doing the PhD are already in place, or you've got a job lined up that you don't need the PhD for. That can be a really good way to just leave. If you are so done with that point part of your life that you're just ready to move on, the MPhil out is a good one. And I love that they offer that, because I think to get to the end and then not have any credit to your name is a bit sad. I mean,
it's the sort of thing, that sort of thing exists for undergrads. Like, if you don't finish, you can leave with certificates of higher education, diplomas of higher education, general degrees. Like, you don't have, like, if you don't complete the full honours degree, there are other things they can give you to recognise you have done stuff.
So that is an option. And I think that one kind of comes at the same level as revivering. Like, essentially, it's sort of, are you in a place where you feel like you can contribute additional work to this? If not, here's this alternative. If you are, here's how you continue through.
Yeah.
And then beneath that, you have a fail.
Yeah, which is just, sorry.
Essentially, yeah. But again, I think when people talk about failing, it's that you haven't passed with, or you haven't passed without. It's that reviver or accepting a master's degree that is like the common failure. I hate that it's called that, but essentially those are the options that like are available to people. After I got told what my results were, my internal made a joke about like, oh, because there were so many ways that you could have failed this. And I was like, right, thank you for saying this after I found out that I hadn't. Mm-hmm. But dude, please don't tease me like this.
So what was the result then?
I passed with minor corrections.
Okay, so that's like, it's not the, this is perfect, it's fine, you can just leave now. It's not the, please get out, this is awful. It's a good one.
it's a good one. And it's one that I think I was mentally prepared for, because as soon as I hit submit, I
found a typo.
So actually, yeah, basically, halfway through a derivation of an equation, I just changed notation.
Okay.
So I went from using one Greek letter to using another without any acknowledgement that that's what I'd done. And I found it near enough instantly after submitting. So actually, my submitting story was really cute. I was in the cafe on campus with three of my friends and my partner, and I was getting really scared about it because it was like, right, it was go time. I'd been emailing my supervisor all day being like, today's the day, it needs to be today. So I'd had the final sign off from him being like, I approve this. This is like, you don't need me anymore. It's up to you if you want to do any more tweaking, but like, you've got my go ahead. So I was sat there and I was like, okay, I'm just going to read it through one more time. Like I kept putting it off, and it takes me about 2 hours to read my thesis. Fun fact. Mm-hmm. So God knows how long it took my examiners.
Cause you know what it's meant to say. Not necessarily what it does say, but at least what it's meant to say.
Yeah, so I'd read through it all and I was like, okay, I can't think of any other excuse. And my friends were like, Kat, just do the thing. So I'd hit send and I was literally hunched up in my, like curled up into a ball on my chair, and I wasn't looking. And I just like, you had to upload it to Moodle and, you know, do the upload. Are you sure you want to submit? Are you sure you want to submit? And I like clicked it without looking. And then I had my head in my hands. And my friends were like, Kat. And so I like look up and they all have party poppers. So we're in the middle of a very quiet cafe. And I have four people around me like with party poppers cheering. So that was really cute and very annoying to everyone else in the cafe. Some people we knew from the department were further down in the cafe and they were just like, what the hell? It's like, sorry. But I thought that was really sweet of my friends to do. And it did give me a heart attack, so that was nice.
I suppose it shocked you out of the sort of, I don't know how to describe that, what that emotion must have been, but you know what I mean.
It's a weird one. I think, so historically, to submit your PhD, back in the old days, in the before times, you had to go hand...
When Simon got his PhD.
Yeah, basically. You had to go hand in a physical copy. So you had to get it bound, the uncorrected one. You had to get it bound and you had to hand it in. And that, I feel like I've heard stories from people, and that's like a big thing because that's like a very physical, like I'm giving it to someone. Whereas just kind of clicking a button on your computer.
PDF go.
I remember when one of my friends, when one of my friends did it over lockdown, it was like they were sat alone in their room and then.
I had that similar sort of experience on my master's thesis. It's just like, well, that was kind of anticlimactic. And I imagine it's even more so when you've spent 4 years on it.
Yeah. So I'm really grateful. And like one of my friends, Beth, like she was the one that sort of instigated this, and it just, it was so sweet. It was absolutely terrifying, but it was such a nice thing for them to do for me, because I really wasn't expecting it. So yeah, that was like, it made what would have been very anticlimactic moment really fun. And like, for me, I think having been through every single part of it now, that was the moment where I felt the most like done.
Done as in finished, not done as in like, oh, I'm done with this.
Sick of it. No, like that was a bigger like rush of relief for me, of being like, I have completed this, because anything beyond that point, I was able to frame it in a mind of like, this is just editing now, this is fine tuning. Mm-hmm. Like I was lucky enough that I trusted my supervisor enough to be like, when he said this is passing, it's just a case of detailing. Yeah. I believed him. And I had it, like, I don't have a lot of faith in myself sometimes. The imposter syndrome does imposter syndrome. But I was able to be like, no, I do back the work that I've written, and I back the content. Now it's just going to be, do they like the fitting? Do they like the trim? Do they like the way that I've phrased things? So I was able to be, going into the Viver, it's just going to be a, like, do they like the way I write? And I have issues with how I write and how I talk. And I struggle to not make one sound like the other. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so for me, the like, this is at the point where you can submit, and like doing that was the biggest like deep breath out, like absolute relief that I felt. So
yeah,
that was really nice.
Okay, so that's, so you submitted, thesis is in. Mm-hmm. You've got, yep, your Viva date, the all that sort of stuff, and you got there. Like, you've obviously said you passed with minor corrections. What was the experience of doing the Viva? Like, what was that like?
Yeah, so again, it's gonna vary place to place, but typically you're expected to give some amount of presentation, and then it's a case of kind of going through the thesis. Mm-hmm. Sometimes line by line to go over any comments, corrections that they have. Yeah. But typically the framing is like, please give us a talk as an overview.
Yep.
And that bit is loosely there to kind of show that the work is yours, and
that you know what it is,
what you're,
yep,
talking about. Yeah. And then they'll come in with essentially like a big edited version of your thesis. One of them had it printed out, one of them had it on a tablet.
All the highlighter, going all through the pens.
Literally page by page of like, oh, do you have anything? My next thing's on page 30. Do you have anything? And then, oh, I have a comment on page 27. Like, it's really, yeah, that. So I got told to prepare a 15-minute talk.
Okay.
I know some people have been given like an hour talk. I know some people have been given a 5-minute talk.
Was yours private? Okay, because I know in some countries it's public.
Ah, yes. So it was essentially, it was in the same room in the maths department at Bath that I had my interview, which I found very cool because I hadn't been in there since. Yeah, so it's just me and the two examiners.
Yep.
Sometimes there's a third person who is like admin from the uni overseeing if the internal is relatively new.
So interestingly, Cardiff does it slightly differently, where you've got your internal, your external, and then another academic from the department acts as a chair.
Yeah. So that I think is the case if either the internal is new to the uni or is quite young. So, but generally the internal takes that role for us. Like, they're the one that does admin, they're the one that did sort of the guiding of it. Whereas my external examiner was the one that was supposed to be like the guy on my knowledge. Yeah. But yeah, so I went in, I was actually in the social space, the staff room next door with my friends beforehand. And they do the thing where they come in like, right, Kat, are you ready? But they didn't do that. They actually said, Kat, do you want to come check your tech before we start? Like, do you want to set your laptop up and things? And this was with like, so my Viva was supposed to start at 2:00 and this was at like 1:45. Yep. I was like, oh yeah, okay, that's fine. That's a long enough time that maybe they'll send me out and I can have a breather and then I'll come back in and go. But I set my laptop up and me and the internal are having a bit of a laugh because we were fucking up the tech, basically. I had to plug into the projector and there were some tech issues because there always are. So we're having this like light, polite banter. Yeah. And then they were like, right, whenever you're ready.
And you were just in survival.
And I was just straight in. They were like, I mean, we can wait for two if you want. And I realized at that point, that's a weird thing to do, to be like, actually, I'm going to go leave, cry next door and then come back. So I was already up and I was like, you know what? Okay. So I started a bit early. But the nice thing about giving that talk that was so different to every other talk I've ever given is those are the two people in the entire world that have read my thesis in very high detail.
Yeah, because they will have read it in probably in more, read the final version probably in more detail than even your supervisor.
Yeah, yeah. So writing that talk is actually incredibly weird. Normally when I think about talks, I think about like audience, you know, format, whatever. But typically the audience aren't as up to date on the knowledge as I am.
Yeah.
Like normally there's some level of explaining.
Yeah, that's got to be a really weird talk to write, because the whole like, the whole background just doesn't need to be there because they've read it.
Exactly. Yeah. So I went for the approach. Yeah. So I got told to explain what's novel about it and sort of give a broad overview.
Mm-hmm.
So I went down the route of essentially sort of summarizing the lit review.
Okay.
Summarizing the core concept of the model. And then a load of videos, because that's the one thing that you can't put into a PhD thesis, into a book, is videos.
That's not yet.
I do know people that have linked to GitHub repos that contain MP4 files and videos. But that was one too many steps for me. They did tell me that might be a cute thing to do, and I was like, no. But yeah, so that for me was like a really nice way to be like, you know what, I'm going to explain the model to them with just a video background to really, because I study fluid dynamics, I study motion. The pictures that I have of like, okay, you can see I'm going to draw a wave and then I'm going to draw the wave at a different time and it's going to be bigger. And like, it's not the best medium for fluids, yeah, in my opinion. Like video showing you the motion is much clearer to get that across. So I was able to kind of essentially, I think I had two slides and then I had like four videos.
Okay.
And I just talked over those videos. So I was like, right, this is the 2D model. And then I was explaining what each of them, I'm like, right, this is moving and you're going to see, right, you see that bit there, that's going to do this. And we think that happens because of this. And then I did that for the 3D and I was like, yeah, obviously I can't plot something in 3D easily, so I was showing things there, and then I had some I really hope my internal isn't going to listen to this. I had some insider secrets from one of his PhD students.
Okay.
They were like, right, your internal examiner loves animations, which was in part the motivation. I'd already decided on doing these videos, but I decided to keep him in a good mood. I was going to leave my slides up while we were talking on a GIF of a bouncing droplet. And genuinely, there were points throughout my Viva where they got distracted.
I was going to say, you better hope neither of your examiners have ADHD.
I think I was banking on it, actually.
Okay.
But it was nice. And I think I was, because of even just doing that, right? Like, I was able to put enough of my own personality into it that, like, I've been doing speaking gigs 3 years now, and like I was able to make it my own in a way that like it meant that by the time that we were going into the right, we're gonna rip your thesis to shreds now, I was in a good mood.
Yeah.
Like I'd had that adrenaline rush of giving a good talk. I was really comfortable. So I think I was really lucky there. So it was stand up, give presentation. I spoke for about 15 minutes. There was about 10 minutes of questions after that on the stuff that I'd said in the Viva, in the presentation, and then sort of more broad scope questions that they had. It helped that one of my examiner's questions was, why does it work so good?
Exactly. Was that an exact quote or?
Yep, literally the words, and I quote, why does it work so good though? That was quite nice.
That's brilliant.
That was very nice for me. So that, because I think as well, my answer was like, I don't know, it just does. But we had a nice chat about numerics and stability and like all the tedious detail that I think that was the first time I've been able to like properly nerd out about with someone. I get to that bit and I think this is going to be quite unique to my circumstance potentially. But my internal turns to me and he's like, right, that's the hard bit done. Now we just go through the thesis. You've answered the questions. You've done the talk. That was the scary bit. Would you like to sit down? And if you get your copy of your thesis out, we'll start going through. Would you like a chocolate bar?
Nice.
So in full like Remus Lupin mode.
You'll feel better.
Basically, so we had a little chocolate break as I was getting asked these questions about my thesis. I was just nibbling on it. And it was like a good, you know, the Tony's Chocolate Only, not sponsored. You know, Tony's Chocolate Only chocolate, like the really nice, like big chocolate bars.
Yes. Oh, yes. I know what you mean. Yes.
Yeah. They break off in weird shapes. I had one. He gave me one of them.
Nice.
Like, it was some top tier chocolate in going on right there. So we sit down. And then, as I said, the procedure at this point onwards is reading through the thesis page by page, where they have comments. So if there was a few pages where they didn't have a comment, they would skip ahead. So remember, at this point, about half an hour has passed.
Yeah.
So I was like mentally preparing for, I would say in maths, I've seen vivas be on average around the 2 to 3 hour mark.
That's certainly similar to physics, as far as I'm aware.
I do know people that have done long vivas. I think the longest I've heard of is 6.5. Jeez. While I've been a PhD student, I have heard horror stories about 8 hour vivas where they stopped and had takeout in the middle. And I've also heard of short vivas as well, but never less than an hour, I would say. I think the shortest I know of is 1.5 hours. But yeah, so about half an hour of presentation and questions. Sit down, have my chocolate bar. I then get told my thesis was a delight to read, which again,
always a good start.
Put me in a good mood. And then the next thing out of their mouths is, right, my first comment is on page 30.
Of how many?
118 at that point.
Wow. Okay, so the first comment is a quarter of the way through.
Yep.
And presumably some of the latter pages of that 118 are references.
Yep.
So probably more like 40% of the way through, there's their first comment.
Yep.
That must feel pretty good.
I was grinning quite a lot at this point. I'm going to be honest, it was a lovely time. So my viva in total was 1 hour 40.
Okay, that's quite short.
Quite a short viva indeed. So we get through it all. I have 3 corrections.
Okay.
So whilst this was happening, as they were giving me comments on each page, I had printed myself a small copy of my thesis to have with me. So I had been making notes as it went along. So I kind of knew what sort of corrections were happening, and I'd already sort of put them in place on post-it notes in my in my thing. So we get through to the end of the thesis and they were like, right, okay. Right, if you want to leave, and I was like, do I get to know things? And they were like, no, we have to talk about it first. Okay. Apparently this is quite common. So they send me out of the room and I'm very aware that all of my friends are in the staff room next door having cake, because it was PhD cake at this point in time. And there were a lot of people in that room. And I was like, right, okay, I don't want to interact with like that many people while I'm waiting. So I'm going to sneak the other way down the corridor and go hide. And they were like, oh, okay, your supervisor should be in this room. Like, go see him. Turns out he was still in his meeting because he thought the viva would take at least 2 hours.
So as he was nowhere to be found.
he was nowhere to be found. So I'm then ducking and diving around the maths building, hiding from everyone because I don't want to bump into anyone because I'm stressed. And then eventually the internal examiner comes and finds me. And then we walk back
Puddled in a ball under a desk somewhere.
I think I'd managed to bump into like a postdoc in the bathroom. So we were having like a nice chat. And then as we left, it was fine. I'd sufficiently managed to hide. So as we were like walked back to where my exam was happening, we walked past the common room. So everyone saw me re-entering the room for the viva. So I heard like shouts of like, wait, what? from behind me. Mm-hmm. But we go in the room and it is as cheesy as everyone kind of describes it to be. So I go in and I didn't really sit down. They were stood up, and my external examiner says like, well, I think we all kind of know what's about to happen, but Dr. Phillips, we'd like to congratulate you on passing your viva with minor corrections.
Woo!
It's such a weird moment because I don't know what to do. I think I jumped. I think I'm a very like bouncy person. Yes, so I think I literally jumped about. But yeah, so they did in fact do the thing where they called me doctor and said, congratulations, doctor. And then there was like shaking of hands. And this is where the like, yeah, because you could have failed so many different ways. So like, this is a really nice, nice result. And I was like, thank you for that.
So, did they elaborate on the many ways you could have failed?
No, because I said like I like doomsday planning. Like, so I had looked into what the different options were beforehand. So I was like, yeah, I know. But yeah, so you do that, you get your congratulations. I had my handshakes, and then we had a sit down, and they basically told me explicitly what the corrections were, because those corrections get sent to the Ethereal Board of Studies, and then I have to do the corrections, and they check that it matches up, or they check that the internal has confirmed that they match up, or whatever. So they were like, you have to do these things. Once we send it to the board, it has to be done. I agreed with all of the corrections, so they were a lot of typos. Basically, it was just like kind of fix a few of the typos. There was one point where I had an appendix and then a table with no words around it, and the formatting had gone a bit squiff. So the table was somewhere else. So it was just appendix and then my references, which made it look like the appendix was the references.
Yeah, just LaTeX formatting being LaTeX formatting.
Yeah. And then the other one, which was like my quote unquote big correction, was add more explanation on the numerics. Just because, again, that like it works really well. Can you explain what's happening here? So just so that we know that you're not like fudging shit, basically. So I just had to write something saying like we'd done numerical validation by increasing the grid size until the solution converged, and all of these like the technical jargon that everyone does, but is not really the interest of my topic. Like, because I care about the fluids itself and like what's happening sort of physically.
It's not the interest of the topic, but it's the sort of thing that it needs to be covered for completeness.
Yeah, yeah. And my internal examiner actually is like, he's sort of fluidsy, but he is very numerical as well. So he was like, I can appreciate that the way these are written is not for me as an audience member. But for the overall thesis, please make sure that you do X, Y, Z. So it was just like, I think I ended up adding in 3 pages, I would say, in my corrections.
Not a huge amount, not inconsequential though.
And it was like as an appendix, and 2 of those pages or 1 of those pages total was like an algorithm of like, actually, if you want to know the detail, here's the step by step. But yes, and then that was it. So they were like, right, you have a month. Is that going to work out with your timeline, with your new job? And actually it worked out perfectly, because first few weeks of my job were very fluffy. So I've had free time. So as of recording this, last week, I finished my corrections and I had the announcement that my corrections were approved. So my internal examiner read them. He was like, good job. Now I upload the final copy, version 3_this1, to the Board of Studies, and all the boxes have been ticked. And then I get an email from them saying, this is your official acknowledgement that you are a doctor. Technically, from that point onwards, I'm allowed to go by doctor. But realistically, everyone knows that it's the Viva is when, like, that's the one. But I've already looked into it. I can't change my sort of bank card, passport, driving license until I have my certificate. Yeah. So I think that comes slightly before grad, but like that's the broad scope of how it works in the UK. So I have been stupidly lucky, I think. I worked really hard for this.
Yeah, don't undersell yourself. You put in a hell of a lot of work and it has paid off.
The final bit, once I submitted after, has been a dream for me to like navigate. It's been incredibly stressful at points getting to that point. Like, it took me 3 months longer to write than I thought it would. And that was writing, you know, I stopped streaming. I stopped sort of socializing a lot. Like, I think I went into quite a heavy place because I was dealing with that expectation that I should be done by now and it should be easy, and it wasn't, and I struggled. And that's why I haven't been recording podcast episodes or doing all my normal things. But the flip side of that is that it did pay off. I think there was a healthier balance there that could have been met, where like I didn't lose all of myself to my write-up, but potentially the aftermath would have been a bit more difficult. I don't know.
At the same time, there are so many things that could have gone differently. For example, your supervisor could have not disappeared off to America.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You could have not had to go out there for 2 months to actually get the support that you needed. Like, it could have gone many other different ways. Like, you haven't had a stable place to stay for a while. And things like that.
7 months. Yeah. And the flip side of this as well is that the reason that it went from taking maybe an extra month after coming back from the US to the 3 months it took is because I started work. When I moved out to the US, it's because my funding ran out. That stipend that we said that we were on, that finished for me in January. And that's why February, March was over in the US, was that compromise my supervisor managed to work for me personally was... I went over there on a research visit with the idea that that was a paper, and it was, but it gave me that time. We did discuss me going back over there after sort of coming back for a conference in April, but I decided, or it sort of fortunately came about, that there was a short postdoc position in Bath that would have been 4 months that... Basically, I did. So those last sort of...
So to clarify, that was before you were technically a postdoc, so you couldn't really be postdoc.
A short research position became available.
There you go.
So essentially, I worked for the last 4 months while I was writing up my PhD. I was also working full-time as a research assistant, I think we're called technically if we're not doctor yet. We're research assistant rather than research associate. So I was doing that, which then meant that my like 9 to 5 was taken up with work and my evenings and my weekends were taken up with thesis. There are pros and cons, obviously the pro being money, the con being no time.
Work-life balance.
Yep, that didn't exist. But unfortunately, once that stipend runs out, there is some compromise you have to build there.
Yeah.
I think for me, in retrospect, probably shouldn't have done it. Just because I went in parts of that to quite a dark place with just having a complete lack of social stuff. I was really fortunate that my PI, so my boss on that research project, was very accommodating. The industrial partners that we were working with were very accommodating to the fact that, you know, I was doing this work for them, but I was also finishing my PhD. We were all kind of aware what my priority was. So it was very like, how can we make this, how can we get the most out of this project while still not killing Kat? So that worked really, really well. And once I was like vocal with them about how much I was struggling, like we were able to readjust. But it can be really intimidating navigating that. And I think it's something that people don't realize is that the funding running out and the end of the PhD don't always line up. People either move back in with family or start working part-time or start working full-time. And you've kind of got to do what makes sense for you sort of financially, but also, you know, please look after yourselves. It's do as I say, not as I do in this situation.
When have we heard that before?
I think every time I do something stupid.
Yeah. And every time I do something stupid, let's be honest.
To be fair. But yeah, so that's why sort of everything disappeared. I think had I moved in, you know, with family or had I gone back out to the US, it would have been a very different timeline, potentially. But I would have struggled financially a lot more. So.
Yeah, the timeline might have been different, but in terms of like getting to the point where you could submit, at the same time, the timeline could have been completely different in that you might just never have got there.
Yes, very possibly. And I think as well, it's one of those things that, you know, how people say about gap years where like if you go away, it's really hard to come back to as mm-hmm. well. I think there's something to be said about that. Like if you start facing out your work with this sort of endless date in mind of like you'll get it done eventually, it's really hard to motivate yourself. So yeah. For me, the fact that we had set my Viva gave me that very hard deadline. So the main reason for that very hard deadline that I had, which was the end of July or mid-July for my Viva, was because at the, all the way back, 1st of March, it was St. David's Day, I had a job interview for a postdoc that wasn't the short-term thing that I ended up doing, but instead was, I don't want to give them too much credit, but like arguably it is my dream position.
Okay, so stakes are high for you, right?
Oh, yes. But I did my interview on St. David's Day, which I definitely had, like, all my Welsh luck going as much as possible. And I think within an hour of the interview, I had a phone call from them basically offering me the job.
I mean, that is the fastest response to any interview I've ever heard.
Yep. I think my interview went really well, luckily. The role is something I'm very... Yeah, okay, fine. But the role was something I was very passionate about, so I think I was very confident sort of going into it that if I'm the sort of person they want, I'm the best one for the job. But I managed to negotiate with them that I didn't want to start that role until after I'd finished, because I can now give my all to it. Which then meant they were like, we compromised on when's the earliest I could start versus when's the latest I wanted to submit. Like, I wanted to give myself the most time to do my PhD, but also I didn't want to lead them on, essentially. So
yeah,
I knew in March that I had this job lined up for August. So the role that I am now in is I am a innovation research associate at the University of Warwick, at the Centre for Applications of Mathematical and Computer Science, or Computational Science.
Okay, that's a lot of big words. Realistically, break it down, like, one sentence, what is that?
So I'm essentially a fixed member of staff, so I'm continually employed by the university, by CAMAX, this centre, but the projects that I work on will be different and varied. So companies, other departments, researchers, institutions will come to us and say they need a mathematician on this topic to help them. And I go in as the sort of, like, quote unquote resident expert, and I do the research for them or alongside them.
Okay, so this is small projects, not sort of fairly limited time frame, more limited scope than, say, a 3-year postdoc position.
Yeah.
So it's more like, it's kind of like, I don't know, like academic consulting sort of thing.
Yeah. So, like, consulting, contracting, that style of work, but my role and, like, me as a person at the university is fixed.
Okay.
So the idea being that people buy out percentages of my time and let me do sort of, say, 30% on this project or 50% on this project for shorter, say, 6-month, 1-year long positions, rather than your sort of typical postdoc where you are hired to be on a specific project for a specific length of time, where all of your time is going towards that. The doubly fun thing about my role at CAMAX at Warwick is
there's more.
And this is what makes it the sort of dream job for me, is that a good percentage of my time is given over to outreach and public engagement. So I am going to be working on projects for the center themselves. I'm going to be working on sort of bigger collaborative things across the university. And then I've also got the sort of flexibility to keep building Cat Does Maths and everything that comes with that. Because I think the way they've kind of explained it to me and the way that I sort of see it is that, like, the reason that I'm such a good fit for those roles and doing those weird things for them is that I have the creative freedom to kind of keep building my own persona. So there's going to be a lot more Cat Does Maths out in the world in the near future, rather than just me kind of sneaking it around my actual day job.
Nice. That must be exciting.
I'm over the moon about it. I think it's something that universities have been realizing that outreach is really important for such a long time. So now the universities are actually starting to let people accommodate it as part of their workload. Whereas before it was that, like, oh, it would be good if you did this, but we're not going to give you sort of time for it.
Yeah, it was always taken as a bit of an add-on thing, the thing that people do to, like above and beyond, which isn't a reasonable expectation. But it's good that things are changing more towards that, and that sounds honestly like a brilliant position. It sounds good. It sounds exciting.
So yeah, I unfortunately no longer have the, like, resident PhD expertise to share, but soon I'll be talking about, you know, career progression and all of that council tax and real adult stuff that people, pension. I now have pension contributions and
wow,
all of the things.
Hey, we've come full circle. We started off talking about pension contributions about 40 minutes ago. I suppose like we've covered a lot of ground today, but like we haven't made an episode in like 5-6 months. So like there was a lot to cover. And yeah, I mean, most of what we talked about today is like, you've done the PhD, but I feel like it's right that we dedicate a bit of time to you've finished. I guess the remaining question is, after all of the stuff, after the thesis, after the Viva, the short-term postdoc, the getting a new job, how do you feel?
Like, one of my friends described it to me as it feels, or they feel like I've gone through my final Pokemon evolution. Like, I have been trying to get to this person or this version of myself for such a long time. And you're going to make me cry. It took a lot of work and parts of it were not fun, but the majority of it was. And I think I'm so lucky to have had a really good supervisor throughout all of it that has been a friend on top of being an incredible mentor. And I've been part of a CDT of, you know, a cohort of PhD students who have been right there alongside me and, you know, cheering me on every step of the way. And I don't think I could, when I applied for PhDs, I don't think I fully realized this is where it would get me. Like, I am living the version of my life that I could have only dreamed about. So yeah, I'm happy. I'm genuinely very, very happy. I'm still really looking forward to just like sleeping for a week at some point. Because I'm not kidding, it was Viva start, like Viva, I think I had 4 days off and then start new job and it's been nonstop. So at some point, your girl's going to take an extended holiday. But
as you should.
But as of right now, yeah, I am so proud of everything I've done. And I know that it wouldn't have happened without like a lot of very incredible people supporting me the entire time. So I just feel very fortunate. And yeah, I am also a doctor and that's f***ing cool.
Yeah, it is. And before we actually do make you cry, I think this is a good place to finish for this episode.
Yeah.
Thank you everyone for listening to the podcast.
Thank you for like waiting for us.
Yeah. And for anyone who's like stuck around with us on YouTube today and has realized that there's no video and has got to the end of the episode and there's still been no video, yeah, we're not doing video anymore. It's way too much work. Check out the stuff in the description or show notes and stuff about where you can find us on social media, where if you send us stuff, we will respond. Say congratulations for Kat and we'll pass them on to her.
Yay.
And we will hopefully see you in the next episode, which will hopefully not be in 5 months.
No, I'm sure we'll manage at least 4.